Welcome to Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to the show. So what are we going to talk about today?
All right, so 2015 came to an end not too long ago. So we thought it would be great to share with our listeners some of the tips and tricks that we have picked up along the way over the course of 2015. What do you think about that?
I think it's good that we share some of our tips and tricks that maybe might not be so obvious to the rest of the community, or even better, what might be obvious to us but are not obvious to other people. Because I can't tell you how many times I've sat down next to another developer, even such as yourself, at a conference, and you'll kind of look over someone's shoulder and you'll see this weird key combination that they do, and you're like, whoa, what did you just do? I think learning all those weird little tips and tricks that you can do in development and outside of development are key. And I think there's something great that we can do for the listeners.
And we might possibly make this like a bi-yearly thing, depending on how things go. Yeah, listeners should let us know if they liked this episode. And if they did and they would like to hear more of these episodes, then we'll probably be more diligent about jotting these points down for the next one. So let us know.
Definitely. Now, we're going to pretty much hop right into this episode here and just kind of hop right into the tips. Now, there's something that we do want to say immediately is that these tips are just kind of in random order. Some are going to be based around development. Some are going to be based around your IDE that you interact with every day. And some are going to be completely not even related to development, but maybe related to your career in general of how you can grow it. So just because we say something in the first few minutes does not mean that it's more important than the items that we speak at the end of the episode. So just keep that in mind as we hop into it. And so how we're going to do this kind of format of this episode is I have a bunch of top tips and tricks I'm going to share. Kaushik has some of his. I'm going to hop into one, and then immediately we're going to just kind of go back and forth between the hosts here. So I'm going to go, Kaushik's going to go back and forth all the way throughout the episode, and then we'll kind of wrap it up.
All right, I'm excited. Let's get this party started.
Okay, so I'll go first. The first tip I have on the list here is actually something very simple. It's just be pragmatic. And what I mean by that is ask yourself, maybe, am I overanalyzing this? You know, maybe you've been assigned a new feature that your product team wants to get out, and maybe it needs to be A/B tested for whatever reason. In my opinion, I tend to write these types of applications or features in a very quick and dirty way, really. And a lot of people don't agree with me in this regard, but the reason I do this is because I learned this at Groupon is, when we developed a feature, sometimes we would get it out, and maybe it might take me a week or two to develop it, but once we get it out, we would realize it totally unperformed and we just needed to throw it away. And so if I had spent that extra week and a half making everything perfect and getting all the bits aligned and making decisions in regards to architecture, I might have actually wasted quite a bit of time. And so at the end of the day, just kind of lean back and ask yourself, am I doing the things the best pragmatic way possible?
My first tip is actually a little more tactical in nature. The first is get the best machine that money can buy.
Yes.
If your company buys your laptop, then convince them to get possibly the highest spec machine. When I joined Instacart, they gave me the option to either get a fully spec 13-inch or a 15-inch MacBook Pro. The dummy that I am, I actually chose the 13-inch because I was like, oh, this is more, this is like more portable, and it is a MacBook Pro, and like, you know, this would be fine. And it was. I mean, it worked perfectly well until I started working with my colleagues, and I noticed when I was pair programming with them, their builds seemed like a little faster than mine. The difference obviously comes where the 15-inch is a multi-core. It has four cores, right? That's why the whole speed difference is noticeable. The other reason is also, obviously, the 15-inch has a dedicated graphics card versus the integrated graphics card on the 13-inch. So when you work with things like GeniMotion and other emulators, that would also make it seem faster. So I got burnt, don't get burnt. And convince your company. A $900 difference is really peanuts compared to the efficiency and productivity you will gain by getting a better machine.
I completely wholeheartedly agree with that. I've been preaching this for as long as I've been in software development. So excellent tip. My second tip here is attempt to adopt a culture of continuous improvement. And what I mean by that is, for example, let's say your code base maybe has some legacy code in it, which we all kind of do have that encounter that situation. Or maybe we just have our app that has no unit testing, and that would never happen to you, would it?
No, absolutely not.
No, definitely not. Right. So now one way you can adopt a culture of continuous improvement is simply by, let's just use a unit testing example. You can solve this by having each developer on your team implement just one unit test per day, per week, Or you can even, if you want to even to be more lax about it, say, hey, everyone needs to write one unit test a week. And so if you have four developers, that's four unit tests a week. And all of a sudden, you, at the beginning of the month, you had zero unit tests. At the end of the month, you had 16. So you can see how this compounds over time. And what this does is start creating these small little islands of testable code, which is, you know, basically little confidence islands that you know that, hey, I can change the code under that because now I have that little piece of code tested. So that is one way to help adopt a culture of continuous improvement. Furthermore, if you have legacy code lying around that needs to get refactored, if you're in there changing something, just refactor it when you're in there. And don't worry about it when you, you know, don't overanalyze it saying, oh, we need to spend 2 weeks doing it. As you encounter these things, fix them then. This is exactly what we did at MyFitnessPal. We had a huge legacy app. And as we approach various screens, we just fixed them when we came into them and built that into our estimate. So just try to keep that in mind when you're doing trying to implement some type of continuous improvement.
Fantastic point. I love the idea of like all the developers write a unit test every week. I'm going to keep that in mind. My next step is the structural find and replace feature in Android Studio. This feature is basically game changing. You should absolutely use it. Recently, I had to upgrade a project from using Butterknife 6 to Butterknife 7. Using structural find and replace, it made it super easy to basically migrate all of like the Butterknife code. In almost, I would say, 10 or 15 minutes, like I was done. It was a breeze to change everything. What is structural find and replace? Just think of it as search and replace for programmers. So it sort of understands your language and the context, and it works amazingly well. Rather than explaining the whole thing, we'll add a link in the show notes to Tor Norby from the Android Tools team demoing this in the Android Dev Summit. It's an amazing feature, and I'm just so used to it. I can't imagine life without it.
My fourth tip here is actually just very high level. Learn design patterns. It's important because you and your team can then have a shared language that you can communicate with that doesn't involve someone explaining something 10 times over and over. So instead of saying, well, you got to kind of put this object into this other object and through like the constructor, and then you can use it. And then you don't have to worry about how to build it. You can just say, hey, we'll just use dependency injection.
Right.
Or, you know, hey, go ahead and use a facade pattern. You know, or maybe I've solved the same type of thing with a visitor implementation or a delegator. Like, just learn these basic design patterns. We'll put some links in the show notes for a couple of the books that we can recommend and maybe websites for the design patterns. But this one has kind of been a game changer for my career.
And the advantage there, it isn't like we're trying to throw jargon and confuse people, but it's actually, it gives them a starting point, right? So if you mention the delegation pattern or like the facade pattern, they actually have something to Google and actually get more knowledge than you could possibly transfer in that communication that you have with them, right? It just makes it easier for them to help themselves.
Exactly.
Brilliant. Okay, so my next one is actually a short one. I've noticed sometimes that actually working in Gradle's offline mode where it doesn't constantly check for updates is actually faster, especially when you have a whole bunch of libraries that need to be synced. So that's a quick and small tip. Now, granted, Android Studio has been developing at a much faster rate, and some of this is just far more intelligent. So eventually we'll come to a point where we won't need it anymore, hopefully. But for the time being, if you work in Gradle's offline mode, I've found it to be just a little faster, especially if you're not changing your libraries around.
Okay, so my fifth tip is understanding FOMO. And FOMO is the abbreviation F-O-M-O, and that is fear of missing out is real. And what I mean by that is just understand that you can't learn it all. Back when I first started learning Android, it was still a very large surface area of development. But we had activities. We didn't have fragments. We didn't really have any libraries. We had services, alarm managers. There was very few things going on in Android, and it was small enough to kind of wrap your entire head around it. Now, Android is huge. Google's released so many libraries out there. So many open source libraries are available. There's just no way to learn at all. It's just not at all. And if you attempt to, you're going to cause yourself so much anxiety that you're going to be like, oh my goodness. And I get this question on Twitter a lot, like, hey, Don, I want to get into Android. I don't know what I should kind of get into first. And my response always is like, look, do what you enjoy doing. If you enjoy interacting with APIs and building apps that kind of do these weird mashups, then do that. If you enjoy the UI development and making things animate and cool, do that. If you enjoy data binding and just kind of the architecture behind it, then do that. Just do what you enjoy. And then when you encounter a situation when you need to use the data binding library and you never have used it, then learn it at that point in time. Just understand that you're never going to learn it all. And as soon as you can understand that, it's just easier to handle in the long run.
Makes sense. Along the same lines for libraries, my sixth tip is actually one that you mentioned to me some time back. I'm not sure if this was in our many conversations offline or it was on the show, but it's Jitpack. Jitpack for shared library dependencies is amazing. You don't have to set up your own Sonatype Nexus repository, or it makes it far more simpler. Basically, what Jetpack is, it's this third-party service that allows you to publish your JVM and Android libraries straight from GitHub, which most people anyway use for their version control. So it's super nifty and a great solution to start with. So if you have common libraries that you share internally, there was a great talk by Kelly Schuster where she mentioned how people use Git's sub-modules. You can use that, or in fact, you can just use Jetpack, which is super straightforward and easy. So I highly recommend Jetpack. I've started using that, and it's been a game changer.
And that's at jitpack.io, is that right?
Yes, that is correct. And we'll make sure to add, like, for all these tips where there's some help or links, we'll make sure to add all of those in the show notes.
All right, so my seventh tip here is spend 5 minutes learning the hotkeys of the main applications that you use. So for example, I use Android Studio, RubyMine, WebStorm, Photoshop, Sketch, Google Docs, and Gmail the most of the day, every day. Now, in just Google Docs, for example, you can type, command and the question mark, and it will get you an on-screen list of the keyboard shortcuts. And the same thing for Gmail. Just understanding what a lot of these things do can save you so much time. For example, in Gmail, I turn on the keyboard shortcuts and I can fly through my email.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because if I know I want to archive it or I want to delete it, it's just a hotkey now. Like, I'm not moving the mouse around. And sure, these are small micro optimizations of your day, but every time I can save a second here and a second there, if I'm doing something 50, 60 times a day, it's a minute or two a day. That kind of stuff adds up. And the same thing goes for Android Studio and any basically IntelliJ-based IDEs. If you're not sure what a shortcut is, you can try to find it by using Command-Shift-A to find an action. Just start typing the name of what you're looking for. Maybe you want to extract something, or you want to refactor or something like that. Just type it in. It'll show you the shortcut and use that. And furthermore, on top of that, you can also install Key Promoter, which is one that I highly recommend. It is probably the most annoying IntelliJ plugin that you'll ever install. What it will do is, if you try to use something that has a keyboard shortcut, it will then immediately pop an annoying pop-up in your face on the IDE saying, hey, you could have done that with a shortcut. And it will kind of block you. And eventually it gets so annoying that you start using the shortcut because you just want to stop seeing this little pop-up.
Couldn't agree more. In fact, even when Hadi was on our show, he mentioned that IntelliJ was built so that you could not have to use your mouse at all. It's all about keyboard shortcuts. So definitely learning the keyboard shortcuts. Amen to that. All right, my next tip is, if you've used Espresso for UI testing, sometimes it becomes a little tricky because you have to find the exact view ID. And if you have to increase the specificity of the test, then you have to find sibling views. You have to find what it's close to. It can get pretty tricky. And sure, you can do that, especially if you have developed the feature. But if you haven't developed the feature, this can take way more time. And this is a common ding against writing UI tests that, it takes time. And so then they're not too fond of writing UI tests. A tip that greatly helps with this is actually there is this tool called the UI Automator Viewer. If you start that tool, if you have your emulator or a device connected and it shows up on screen, the actual view that's seen on screen is sort of like dissected. So when you have Automator Viewer and there's a button up there, and we'll add a link to a video that actually shows how this is done. What it does is it basically takes whatever's shown on screen and it slices it down to the different views. So you can actually see all the attributes that are present on it that you would otherwise have to find out in your Espresso test. So having a look at that, it makes it really straightforward to write your UI test, because you can just say, oh yeah, this attribute's on that view, that attribute's on this view, and then you can just like slap it onto your UI test. Don, do you have a video explaining how this is done by any chance?
I do. It's on caster.io. It's episode 23, using a UI Automator Viewer to help write Espresso tests. It's exactly what you said. I've been using it for years, and I completely agree with this tip. It actually saves a ton of time. It kind of seems like one of those weird products that was released with an ancillary use that probably gets more use than what it's actually supposed to be used for.
Right. Okay, we'll add a link to that in the show.
All right, so we'll move on to number 8 here. I'm going to build on my last item, which is learning the hotkeys of the applications that you use. This is kind of, again, ancillary to that. If you can't find a shortcut for something that you do inside of your IDE all the time, then create that shortcut. For example, I found myself always going up and refreshing my Gradle dependencies, clicking on the link in the IDE, going up to the toolbar. Eventually, I decided that was too much, and so I implemented a a shortcut for that, and that's command plus shift plus option plus G. So it's a little bit of, keyboard gymnastics to get that to work, but I'm used to it now. And so anytime I need to refresh my Gradle dependencies, I can do it from anywhere. I don't have to have the file open. I just hit that command and it's off and running. The other one that I use also a lot of times was I wanted to see what the diff was, because as you may or may not know, Android Studio has a built-in code diff viewer. So it will show you what's changed. And you can right-click and you can view what's changed from your source control. Again, I found this to be too slow, so I implemented another one, and that was Command-Shift-Option-D, and that would show a pop-up dialog of what changed since the last commit in my local repository inside of that diff window. So I can kind of see if I made a bunch of changes, like, oh, goodness, what's changed? Hit that command. I get the diff pop-up right there in IDE. I can check it out, hit Escape, close it. I haven't touched the mouse, and I'm off and running again.
Another one that I added a custom keyboard shortcut, and I'm not sure if there's a default one. It's the attached to debugger, as like in a future tip. Yes. I'll mention, I'm a big fan of using the debugger. I assign a custom keyboard shortcut to that because I've found myself using it enough for time to add a keyboard shortcut.
I have a custom one for that one as well.
Brilliant. All right, so my next tip is the beauty of Git pre-commit hooks. So if you're working in a team, sometimes what happens is you might commit stuff that you probably don't want going up to your repository. In our team, we've been burnt by this one. So basically what I did is I added this thing called a Git pre-commit hook. And it's a very simple thing. It has nothing to do with GitHub. It's pure Git. I can add like a gist to the Git pre-commit hook that we use. The way I've created this Git pre-commit hook is that if there's the word hacking in any of your comments, essentially what it does is it prevents you from committing that change to Git. And this is super helpful because say you want to get your whole application flowing through a very specific path, and so you hard code certain variables in your program. We've all done that before. It's fine. I add a comment there with the word hacking. And what happens is as you develop this app, you may tend to forget that you have this thing put in your code and you don't want that to go in. 3 or 4 days later, when you try to commit, it'll pop up this big error message saying, hey, are you sure you want to be doing that? And this Git pre-commit hook that I have actually specifies the line number where this hacking comment is put in. So the next time I come back in, I would remember that, oh yeah, this is something that I don't want committed. I can like uncomment and remove the code. So we found that to be pretty helpful. So I'll add a gist link.
All right, my ninth tip here is very short. Use the terminal panel in Android Studio. It's much faster than tabbing over to your terminal window. You can hit Alt plus F12 and that will toggle the terminal panel, and then you can start typing from right there. You can perform your Git actions. You can do command line execution. So it's basically just a terminal inside of Android Studio.
All right. The next tip that I had is basically automating your build and release process. This is pretty straightforward. It isn't difficult per se, but having to remember each and every single step is kind of a pain. So basically what I did is recently I wrote a very simple Ruby script that essentially just provides a one-line command. So on the terminal, I would execute the command release, and it basically just does all of this for us. In addition, there's also like some helpful stuff that it does. So it checks if your Git workspace is clean. So if you have uncommitted files, it says, hey, are you sure you want to be committing? Like you have uncommitted files, so make sure you commit those into Git. It then runs a clean build of using the Gradle release command. It automatically upgrades the version number in the app. So if we say release major, release minor, or release patch, then accordingly it bumps up the right version number. It also gives this helpful message saying, hey, you're currently on version 4.11.2 and we are upgrading to 4.12.0. Are you sure this is what you want? So that way you know you're not messing up the version numbers, because obviously, in Android, that is kind of like a sacred number. Once you bump up a version, you can't bump down. So you want to be careful of that. It just takes care of a whole bunch of these things without us having to think of any of this. It packages the release, asks me if I want to Git tag the branch for release, copies the APK onto my desktop, also posts it onto Slack, and basically just outputs a very helpful reminder to the person saying, hey, we've done all these changes. Make sure you push it up to GitHub because we don't do that automatically. And my colleagues have said this is like super useful just because like they don't have to think about it. And like, you know, when you're on the verge of release, like things are moving fast. They're just writing this one command and it taking care of all of it for you is super helpful.
That's a great tip. So basically you have a nice little deployment script ready for you and any of your teammates at any time. That's cool. All right. So my 10th tip here is save time by knowing where your files are at inside of your IDE. So for example, in Android Studio, sometimes you're working on a file and you really like to know where it's at inside of your file structure. And so you usually end up kind of looking at the path or the package name, or maybe up in the panel where it shows the location of it. You can easily find out where the file is at by hitting Alt F1 and Enter, and that will take you and highlight the file directly inside of your project structure. So help save a little bit of time there.
Nice. My next tip is actually, and this is my 10th tip. Gradle is basically written in Groovy, which is a programming language. And one of the biggest advantages with programming languages is that you can use variables. And what this means is you can use variables in your build script. And the way I use this is basically for sharing version numbers across all our projects. Now, whenever you want to upgrade your support library version, or if I want to bump up Rx Java's version, we have this shared library that uses some of these libraries, or even Google Play services, right? The way we have sort of worked it out is like all of this is stored as a single variable. So we point to this variable throughout all our Gradle scripts. And whenever we want to bump up the version number, all we have to do is just bump the version number up in one place and boom, all the places are nice and consistent. Now, granted, sometimes you may not want this, but more often than not, you do want this, because recently we ran into this bug where if your support library versions across all libraries don't match, you'll run into this strange sort of cryptic error. Mm-hmm. So that's when I was like, oh God, this, like, we can't be doing this in 2016. So that's why I added that script. And it's super helpful now because everyone's nice and consistent. And if we run into bugs, then everyone quickly runs into those because everyone's using the same version number, right? So version-specific bugs, we found that to be super helpful too.
That's an awesome tip. So building on actually yours, my 11th tip here is to keep your dependencies in your build.gradle file organized, which means that in your dependencies block, keep all of your Android test and your test compile and all those dependencies together. So keep all your test dependencies together, keep all of your Android test dependencies together. Just kind of separate them with them a little bit of space, you know. White space can be your friend here. It'll help you just visually know where things are at. And furthermore, it just helps you be able to quickly hop in to each one of your applications or libraries and quickly make a change or determine if something is there or not. So just pretty simple.
My next tip is actually one that I posted on Twitter some time back. So I have this daily morning ritual. Now, the thing is, with Android, you constantly have updates. And when I get into the office, when I open up Android Studio, the thing that I hate to see all the time is like, oh, you have updates pending, or hey, update this. So essentially what I've done is I have this cron job that runs this single line command that I have. I'll add a link to that. I also posted it on Twitter. And it essentially what it does, it updates all the things that I need to update. So even like I use a Mac, obviously, as we mentioned before. So it makes sure that it picks up the OS X updates. It does all my Android SDK updates. I use this thing called Homebrew. It runs my Homebrew updates. It runs the updates I need for some of the plugins that I have in Atom, which is the editor I'm using currently. It just does all of that in like one command again. So it's super helpful. In the morning, I get up. As my machine comes up, the cron job kicks in. Boom. It all works. So I found that to be pretty helpful.
It'd be pretty cool. I'll be interested to see what that looks like because I know I could use it. Okay, number 12 here for me is adopt a file structure for activities and fragments. This is very similar to the build.gradle one I just talked about. Personally, I like to follow for the activity and fragment classes I use, I like to follow the activity and fragment lifecycle. And what that means is in my files, I like to make sure that my statics and fields are all at the top. And then I have my constructor. Actually, we don't use the constructors in the activities and fragments, but if it's not an activity or fragment, I'll have the constructor there. Below that, I will have all of the activity and fragment lifecycle. So for example, in the activity, I'd have the on create and then the on pause, on resume, all those kind of things that have them in the proper order of the lifecycle. Now, a lot of people don't do this. Some people prefer to do it inside of a kind of a alphabetical structure. I like to do it because it just simply makes sense and lines up to how Android does everything. And when new developers kind of come in, they can immediately see that structure and be like, okay, I know that all the lifecycle methods are at the top. Everything else is below all those different lifecycle methods. It's just one of those things that helps save time, and it also creates this consistency in your code base, which helps, again, speed things up as a developer.
Nice. All right, so my next tip is essentially using the debugger's call stack. Now, especially when you're working on newer projects or a project that you were not a part of from the beginning, sometimes it becomes a little hard to understand where things, like how things happen. So say you want to find out all the places where a network request is about to execute. The easiest way to find this out is using the debugger's call stack. So before you have the network request executed, just put a debug breakpoint there. Run Android Studio, use the app as normal. And when it hits the breakpoint, all you have to do is open up the call stack. And inside that call stack, it'll actually show you each and every single method that has been called. So you can trace your way up to the point of interest where your methods have been executed. So the debugger, I use this debugger call stack like crazy, especially if there are like certain open source projects with samples and they're significantly complex where I can't understand where the calls are being triggered from. I found this to be super helpful.
That is a great tip, and I use that as well. Number 13 for me today is try to learn a new language this year. And I'm not talking about learning Spanish or French or anything like that. I'm talking about learning a new programming language. And now I'm not saying master it. What I am saying is follow the Pareto principle, and that's the 80-20 rule. Learn about 20% of the language. It'll get you about 80% of the benefit. This will expose you to all kinds of different paradigms and interesting things in our industry and in the language, and will broaden your horizons as a developer. So for example, you could go learn JavaScript or Go or Ruby, or just kind of pick a language and just try to learn it this year and build a quick little test project and have fun in it and expand your horizons.
Yeah, very cool. All right. My next tip is, this is actually a tip that not many people know, but it's actually super useful. So Cyril Motier, an amazing Android developer, he writes some of these blog posts, especially with regards to like the UI, amazing stuff. This is quite some time back. He basically posted this blog post on grid spacing. Now, the linear layout actually has two attributes called divider and show dividers, if I remember correctly. Not many people know about this because I've noticed in many code bases, basically when you have line separators that look a little different, people actually add empty views, like dummy views with a background drawable. And so that emulates the divider. There's a much easier, nicer way, and this is as part of the SDK, and that is basically the divider rules for linear layouts. So I'll add a link to the show notes. This is really good because imagine the case where you have a linear layout and you want spacing only in between the elements, right? If you had this view separator, then you would have a little more logic to make sure that, oh, if the first element is hidden, then you want the first separator to also be hidden. You don't want to be writing all of that logic. All you have to do is use the option middle in show dividers for this linear layout attribute, and you have that logic straight away.
Interesting. So number 14 for me is, to grow as a developer, one of the best things you can do is actually try to contribute to open source. The reason why I say this is because you're going to learn a ton. Each project is managed differently, and you'll learn how to work on a team of truly distributed folks. And this is very, very eye-opening for various different reasons, because just the exposure you're going to get. Now, if you're not sure where to start, my best recommendation is to, A, just find an issue that you can solve inside of the issues list and submit a pull request for that. Maybe there's not an issue there and you still would like to contribute to the project because you really love using it. If you've read the documentation and noticed a typo, go in and submit a pull request to fix the documentation. Everything helps. Every open source maintainer usually loves all kinds of these little, you know, even the small little typo fixes, because that means that they don't have to go do them themselves and you're helping out. So just hop in and see if you can contribute to open source. Try to fix an issue here and there. You're going to end up creating a larger network of developers and grow at yourself as an engineer too.
Yeah. Adding one more to your previous tip. Also, another mechanism is writing tests for the open source repository. It's so simple to add unit tests, and most of the open source maintainers really appreciate that, because everyone wants tests, but you know, people tend to get a little lazy about writing them. So if you do it for them, they'll be more than happy.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree.
All right. My next tip is using nice and nimble util libraries. Now, as I've gained some experience, I've realized that I hate the not invented here syndrome. So the NIH syndrome, it's the absolute worst. In fact, I go to the opposite end of the spectrum. If there is like a third-party library or dependency that actually helps take care of this small functionality that I want, then I rip out the code that we have and I actually use like the third-party dependency. For example, a logging library, Jake Wharton has this thing called Timber. I use that instead. Like previously, we had like this sort of custom logger where we would pipe part of like the errors to Crashlytics and pipe some of the other functionality to other places, show it in your ADB log. Timber is like this library that actually does the same thing. I'm a big fan of using as many third-party libraries, but very, very small and precise libraries. We have date utils. Time zones are possibly the most fun problem that developers have all the time. We have like this date utils that just takes care of a lot of that stuff for us. And as previously mentioned, I post all of those on Jitpack, so it's super straightforward for me. And more importantly, when I'm working on my app, I don't have to worry about this. This is somebody else's problem. And that's amazing, because if there's a bug in Timber, then I'll just let Jake or one of the other amazing open source contributors fix that. Like, I don't have to write a fix for that on my own. So that I found that to be a great strategy. Nice and nimble util libraries.
All right, number 15. This one is not so related to developing software, but at the same time it is. And that is, try a standing desk if you haven't already. I recently posted an article where an individual was in his early 30s and he basically had some condition where he was short of breath or his leg was going numb, something weird like that. I forget exactly. But the short of it is, it was a life-threatening condition from having blood clots build up because he was not being too active. Now, a standing desk is not going to solve this problem completely. It's just going to help augment your lifestyle so you're a little bit more, you're standing up a little bit more. Standing up too much can also be damaged for you. But just in general, trying a standing desk can do major things for you mentally and physically. Just that simple change can spark different parts of your brain, get the blood flowing. You'll find you're sometimes are more creative when you're standing. For example, I kind of fidget a lot and I'll be moving around. I'll put my leg up on the desk and kind of stretch out a little bit. Now, if you want to do this and you want to try a standing desk and you've checked them out online and you're like, oh my God, I don't want to spend $700 or more on a standing desk, it's very easy to be cheap. There is that $22 standing IKEA desk, which has been all over, which I actually have had one for 4 years, and it works great. If you don't want to spend any money at all, just grab an ice chest that's in the garage, throw it up on the counter. If you don't have an ice chest, grab that Amazon box that just showed up with all those comic books you just ordered and put that on top of your desk and use that and just put your laptop on top of it. Just sit up for a little while. Just make sure that your arms are bent at about 95 to 105 degrees when typing. So you just want them a little bit extended more than 90 degrees. If you're at 90 degrees or less than 90 degrees, it means your keyboard's too high and you can kind of start putting some kinks in your elbows and your hands might go a little numb. So anyway, that's my tip. Just try a standing desk. It can do crazy good things for you.
All right. So my next tip is this is an issue that Tor Nurbi, again, of the Tools team and also of ADB podcast, he raised this issue where basically there's a problem with Maven Central in that they have a super huge index. The Maven index is really huge. It takes up almost 1.5 gigs of download speed and disk space. We'll add a link to the actual bug that he raised, which is why also if you have noticed now they've started moving to JCenter. So all their Gradle references point to JCenter at this point. And some of the new libraries that they release, the snapshots all go in from JCenter. I'll add a link to the actual bug that he raised. He explains it in much more detail.
Excellent. I've been using JCenter for a while and have had nothing but good results. Okay, so my last tip for today is always test your app on a low-end commodity device. If you're a developer, most likely you have a pretty high-end device, and most likely it's probably a Nexus device if you're an Android engineer or not, or something very close to it. Owning a Nexus device or anything close to it is like driving the Mercedes of Android phones. I think Chet Haas said this in one of his talks recently, that it's like you have a really high-end phone. A lot of the phones that are coming out now are of the speed of a Nexus 4, of the low-end ones. And so what you need to do is make sure your app runs really well on these low-end commodity devices. So go out and find yourself that Ford Pinto of the Android phones. And you could do this, just go to Walmart. And I bought a cheap $9 track phone as an Android phone. It has insanely terrible specs. And test your app on that thing and just to see how well it works. And this tip, actually, I'm going to throw this right back to Michael Bailey, who was on one of our previous episodes. And he recommended I start this, and that's where I got it from. And you take this, really low-end device and make sure your app works well enough. And it works well on that. It'll probably work well on these larger-end devices. This is the same thing, actually, that audio engineers do for music CDs and for, all the hit songs you listen to. A lot of them will produce the music on the very nice speakers. And then what they'll actually do is unplug it and put it into these crappy little computer speakers or even into the phone and then see what the produced music sounds like through that. And if it sounds real terrible, they know that they have some work to do because they need to flip a few things. The same thing goes for Android apps. If your app doesn't work on a really low-end commodity device, that means a lot of the users out there are going to have a terrible experience and you're going to want to fix that before you ship.
Oh, absolutely. Speaking about the audio engineering stuff, a thing that we used to do in the old days is essentially, you know how cars used to have their radios, where you have you would have cassette players. So yep. You'd actually mix the music on cassettes and go for a drive and actually play the music on cassette with horns blaring all over, and then you're driving across the street. And if it still sounds good, then you know you've done your job well. So yeah, I love that tip. Perfect. Okay. And my last tip is essentially using the deprecated annotation. I found that especially even for your internal APIs, if you want to move from using a method, say you have an alternative method or an alternative API that you want your colleagues to use, sometimes it's difficult to say, hey, Don, use this method from now on. Hey, Judy, use this method. Hey, Tim, use this method. You don't want to be doing that. Code allows you to do that. The deprecated annotation, and Android Studio has this nice feature where if you mark a method as deprecated, every time you use it, it has this strike through. If your colleagues use this method, they'll see the deprecated sort of strike through. And that's a way of telling them that, hey, you should stop using this method. And if you're a good citizen for the old API method, you'll also point to the alternative method that they should be using instead of this one.
Completely agree. I use that all the time, actually.
Nice. All right. We'd love to hear what you thought about this episode. We have a whole bunch of other tips that we've just been collecting. So if you think this episode was useful and you'd like to hear more of these, then let us know on Twitter and we will try to come up with another episode. What do you think, Don?
We've gotten a few people who've talked to us and given us tips here and there, and people I've talked to at various conferences. So if you have any interest in hearing anything like this, any tips or maybe even productivity style episodes, please let us know, because your feedback is what helps guide us in this show. And so anything that you guys can provide to us as the hosts will help us deliver exactly what you guys would like to hear.
If people want to get in touch with you, Don, what's the best way to do that?
Usually the best way is going to be through Twitter, because it's a fast reply. And you can hit me on Twitter at Don Felker, or if you want to send a longer form email, you can go to my website at donfelker.com and hit me up on the contact page.
Very cool. Also the same thing. I'm actually really bad at emailing. Terrible at email. So if you want to get in touch with me, probably
don't send him an email. No, it's good.
No, I mean, actually, I don't mind email. It's just that I feel really bad every time I respond to users because I take so long because I'm just very intimidated by my email inbox. So Twitter is usually a better way to get in touch. I'm Kaushik Gopal at Twitter. My website is kausch.co, so if you want to have a look at some of the other things that I do, that would be a good place. Thank you, folks, for listening, and we will catch you in the next episode.
Bye.